Well, to start off with, how long have you been playing guitar?
I've been playing guitar, I think, 20 years. Yeah, I started off when I was about 3 or 4 on a little four-string tenor that my father had, just doodling on it, you know. Yeah. Played that till I was about 10, and my father gave me a 6-string. And I had that and been just doing it all that time, kind of off and on when I was a little kid, just for recreation, you know, sit around the house and play.
Excuse me one second.
It's okay.
Numbers. One is
2027.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay. You must have been pretty good by the time you were 10 or 12.
Well, when I was about 13, I was starting to hit something, you know, because I didn't have any idea of what I wanted to play or even achieving anything on the instrument. I just did it because I liked the sound of it and I liked records. And when I got to be about 12 or 13, it occurred to me to learn what other people had played, you know, because it was challenging to sit down with a record and put the needle on and play a couple of seconds, learn that succession of notes, maybe 4 notes. I used to cop old Josh White riffs, you know, blues riffs, without even knowing what it was. It was just a good sound, maybe 2 bars worth. Take me a week, you know. But after a couple of years of doing that, I got better at it, and I learned a lot of music that way, you know. In fact, I learned all of the kinds of music I like now from records, and then I've added what I could.
What kind of music were you listening to then?
Well, my parents had Josh White and they had Woody Guthrie. They were liberal, you know, and they had a few of those things. It was folk to them, you know. It was just what people were into who were liberal and part of that whole movement, you know. So they didn't know about blues, and they didn't, my father's classically oriented. He knew all his Schubert and his Beethoven and everything, so I had that in my head too, but it was remote. I didn't really pay attention to it. It was kind of a backdrop all the time. And once I got started on this Josh White thing, I found that I just sort of gravitated towards the blues things that he did, which he did kind of half, you know, foggy do, which was kind of lame. And then he did these old blues tunes. It turns out that he'd had corny arrangements of, but at the time it was hot stuff as far as I could see, you know. And then Charters found Lightning Hopkins down there and did this Folkways album of him, which was really a revelation, you know. It's really into something. So I used to sit with my Lightning Hopkins record, you know, and get into it. And it just was at a time when people were reissuing, or actually albums were appearing in a kind of an urban blues revival, you know, the early, very early, you know, that's about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And 8 or 9 or 10 years ago, and I used to just sit all the time with those records, you know, and got better. And then ran into Fred Gerlach, who was, he's from New York, he was a 12-string. First guy to pick up a 12 after lead belly and do something with it. He taught me finger picking, or the idea of training your hands, because I had no discipline, you know, or no musical training at all.
Yeah.
So he taught me the idea of that, training your hands to do, you know. He says you can't just sit down and play. These guys sound like they're doing something simple. Lightning Hopkins sound like he's just sort of banging away on the thing, but what you need is dexterity, you know, and you get that through just training. So I practiced, much as I hadn't liked to practice, but I did. So then the records got to be easier to get things off records. It's systems, you know, little systems, finger-picking systems and all that kind of stuff. And then the Delta Blues is another thing. And that's very hard to play, you know. Charlie Patton and Robert Johnson, that came along. I was about 15. Those records appeared, and Bottleneck and everything, really great.
You were about 15 when you started playing Bottleneck.
Yeah, right. That's when that Robert Johnson on Columbia came out, and everybody picked up on it, you know. And I couldn't visualize the Bottleneck too well because it was, I couldn't figure out from listening to the record what the guy was doing. If you can see somebody play, you know, it clears it all up.
Yeah.
So I had to wait just in the dark until I had John Fay. He said, well, he does it like this, you know. And he played a few notes because he couldn't really.
Okay. Hello. Mike, hi.
How old are you now, may I ask?
I'm 23.
Yeah. You've got a real head start on things. How long have you been playing professionally?
I've been playing professionally, making money at it, since I was 15. And that came about just because in L.A. at that time, when the folk thing was coming on real strong, mm-hmm. there weren't many people who could play very well. And now, it's technique is everywhere. Kids, I see kids, little kids that can play rings around me technically. You know, they have the facility. It just seems to be automatic with them. Mm-hmm. But in that time, there was maybe two or three people in Los Angeles who had put any time in on the instrument. People were just starting, mm-hmm. going around buying guitars, taking lessons and stuff like that. And I already knew, you know, from a lot of years of just doodling. So it was, I started working at the Ash Grove with Jackie DeShannon, oddly enough, who was trying to be a folk act then. It was real funny. Mm-hmm. You know, she got up there, and then what her idea of folk was to put on gingham dresses with a lot of ribbons in her hair,
yeah.
and cry when she sang 900 Miles, you know, and people just walked out. They said, oh, hot dog under glass, you know. And they walked out of the place. But that was, I made, you know, what I made money at it, you know. And then from that, I went into playing blues with Taj Mahal, who came all of a sudden, showed up in Los Angeles, very unknown. Also at the Ash Grove, you know, he had an act, a little folk act, you know. We got together with a bass and a drummer, decided to just play Delta Blues, had no ideas, pre-Paul Butterfield, you know, city hype, electric music, you know.
Yeah.
I just, at that point, picked up the electric guitar and said, well, without any kind of priming from any other sources, because I didn't listen to electric music at all.
Mm-hmm.
Howlin' Wolf, I knew, was like derivative of Charlie Patton, and he was a great singer and everything. But I didn't know a thing about it, and so we just sat down in this teenage fair in Hollywood in the booth for Martin Guitars and played electric, you know, Delta Blues, I guess. It was the first time on the coast, anyhow.
Hmm.
Any city kids had done it. So naturally, Columbia Records came around and said, okay, sign here, you know. And that was in total ignorance. We signed to Columbia, and there was no relationship with them anyhow. They just were scraping it up, you know, and didn't really have any idea what to do with it. And then the rock thing began to skyrocket, you know, really got started. The band that we had wasn't good enough to make it. It was unique, but it wasn't really very good.
Mm-hmm.
So I quit that, and Taj went on his own, and I started doing studio work, which right about then was changing into, this is about 65, let's say, was changing from, you know, the old line way of doing things where you just have guys sitting, reading parts,
mm-hmm.
and playing the same way, year in and year out, you know.
Yeah.
It was changing, like rock and roll was becoming more systematized and scientific, and also guys were appearing like Jack Nitzsche, who had ears for, like, interesting sounds, you know.
Yeah.
From the Phil Spector records that he made.
Right.
Got into, you know, a new idea of making a rock record. It's like pre-Phil Spector, I guess, at least with white music.
Mm-hmm.
Rhythm and blues was way ahead, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, Howlin' Wolf made like 300 Pounds of Joy and records like that are actually good rock and roll records, aside from being blues. And I remember Bobby Womack came out with It's All Over Now when he was with the Valentinos, which is still, I think, a way ahead. I mean, that record came out in 64 or 5, and it was perfect, you know. I think it's the best rock record I ever heard. And yet, white music wasn't anywhere near that. To my ears, you know, it was corny. And that teenage thing, let's say, all that down the aisle of love type stuff, you know, became something else. I guess Spector sort of transformed it into the new sound, you know. I don't know rock history very well.
Did you ever do any sessions with Spector?
No, I was too young. By the time Nitzsche left Spector, I was getting into it, and then Nitzsche heard me play Bottleneck when he went on his own as a producer. And that's when, what I started to say was, before I got all bollocks up in that, when I started to say, he got the idea to hire guys who were good, uniquely good in some area or another, and could lend some kind of sound to a record. And that's why the Bottleneck was good, a hook for me, because nobody else in L.A. could play it.
So you were sticking to Bottleneck, more or less.
Well, I was asked to do it. See, Nishi would say, put Bottleneck on this tune, and I'd say, oh, how strange, you know, a rock tune, but I'll do what he says, you know. And I played Paul Revere and the Raiders, a couple of things, and I was very ignorant, you know. I didn't know how to read music. I still don't. Mm. And I had to remember all the changes and all the little signs on the paper. What the heck is this, a coda and a DS thing, and to ask people. And then remember the whole part, you know, take after take. Good training, though, make it quick. And so I started doing that, and I made a lot of money for a couple of years doing studio work. But it was just so dull. Didn't, you know, I could see that it was going nowhere.
Were you doing any live performance during this time?
No. I did, once in a while, I'd go and I'd show up at some club where some friends of mine were playing, and we might just jam, you know, it was a relaxed kind of thing. And then one thing led to another, and I went to England and with the Rolling Stones and did some work with them. And I went on the road with Johnny Rivers a couple of times just to make some money. And Buffy St. Marie came here to New York, always as a, you know, like, side man.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I saw your name on Let It Bleed, on mandolin. Yeah. Did you do any guitar work with them?
Well, I did a lot of guitar work that they didn't use for tracks. Mm-hmm. See, they took the guitar work that I did, made it into songs, and then recorded them. So you might say that a lot of the guitar work on Let It Bleed is sort of influenced by the kind of thing that I was laying down when I got there, and they weren't really into much of anything.
Mm.
So we sat around and jammed, and they got ideas because they're like me, you know, they sponge stuff up, see a new, hear a new thing, and just incorporate it into what they were doing. Honky Tonk Woman's a good example of that. I don't mind saying that now because it's so, you know, just the way things work out. I did some tracks, though, that aren't released, and Christ, there's an eight-hour jam that we did, that's there is a tape of it somewhere.
Hmm.
It would make a nice album. You know,
you think it'll ever be released?
I don't know. They're very guarded about their music and who they give credit to.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I doubt that they prize this guitar thing that they've built up. I mean, they've done a lot for rock and roll guitar. Brian Jones was the first, I guess you'd say, city guy to record Bottleneck. It was out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a group, they picked up on these things a lot before anybody in England did, anyhow. And they really guard that, their identification with their, with like good rock guitar sounds, because I think they get great, and Keith Richard gets a great sound, you know. And so I don't know if they'll release any of that stuff that we did with me on it, because why should they, you know? It's like Little Richard said, why should I play with John Fogerty, you know?
Yeah.
Same kind of attitude. In a way. So I got it in mind then to go over there, and because I got to be friends with Charlie Watts and do some tracks with him and Bill Wyman for me, you know. And I think they would, I was going to do that before I came on this tour. I actually had it all set up to go and record in England, you know, because I do like Charlie a lot. He's a great drummer.
Mm-hmm.
He could probably really get some things down. But I may not do that. I don't know. It doesn't matter much anymore. This thing of credit, who's on the album, is kind of passe.
Yeah.
A lot of people going around doing that now. But you got to get good musicians where you can find them, and I just don't have a very easy time relating to other musicians.
Mm.
I've had a hell of a time, you know. People couldn't play that Delta rhythm, and I still don't know bass and drums that can fit that stuff too good. So I had to tailor it a lot on that record that I made, the album, to, you know, so that I could get something out there that other musicians could come along with, you know. Or just do it all myself, like on Franz Chance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did everything except the drums and piano. I had to sit with Richie Hayward for 5 hours to get him to play the overdubbed drums on that piece, you know.
Mm. Yeah, there's a kind of drumming on that record that you don't hear much, at least I haven't heard much. I was wondering how, they're like snaps, they're things that sound like whip cracks.
Yeah. Well, Brownsville, you might be thinking of. That's the very slow thing. That was Nitsche banging on a, he was banging on something. I think he was hitting an orange crate or something. And we had this guy, Milt Holland, who's the greatest percussionist, I mean, that I know, who has studied percussion all over the world. And his roots are in, like, Chicago jazz, Baby Dodds and everything, New Orleans stuff. So he's not influenced at all. See, when you run into musicians who are influenced by the last 6 months of Top 40 radio, and roots go back maybe 2 years, you don't have a rapport. I mean, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Take a guy like Mil Holland, who's played every kind of music in the world, you know, and he doesn't even think about the Hollywood groove, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's other than the fact that he's making a lot of money, he just hears music. He doesn't hear it in terms of where's that bag, you know?
Yeah.
He just plays. Like, he played drums on Pygmy, which we wrote to sound like an old field band or an old, say, street band, you know? We wrote it, Char Van Dyke wrote out with my kind of direction, fumbling around since I don't read or write music. He wrote this chart that was very difficult. I mean, if anybody listens to those parts, it's cello and trombone and everything. Very convoluted.
That's incredible. It's weird. It sounds like wrong notes, but
right,
but
exactly.
It sounds, when you listen again, it sounds very precise.
Yeah. See, the point there was we couldn't get players. You can't get players to duplicate the old bands. The New Orleans guys fingered in a traditional way, and they breathed backwards or something, which is a style like bottleneck or blues mandolin that's regional and not, it's not carried forth. People don't learn it. Mm-hmm. Again, once this last bunch, George Lewis died, for instance. So there's not going to be any more of that. So you can't get those players. What we did, we wrote this chart in such a way to stumble those L.A. horn players who come in, they get out of their Rolls Royce, you know, and they come in with the Chinese mustaches, you know, and yellow sunglasses. And, yeah, man, I cop this gig. You know, let's see the chart, man. I can dig it. What's this? You know, they see this chart. Stumble through it the first time, and oh my God, who wrote this? What is this? You know, they really were not angry, but just very contemptuous of it.
Yeah.
We gave them one take.
That was it.
And played it back. Oh my God, they said, I see. Well, let us do it again, please. And nope. you did it, and you have to live with it, and that's what we like anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But but it's wrong. You see, it's so uneven. So that's precisely the point. Well, they didn't understand that.
Yeah.
See, so we thought that was funny. I mean, that's the way we wanted it to sound. Mm-hmm. So it was done intentionally, and I think that the idea of doing that Leadbelly tune with that great plodding rhythm, you know, is... I love that song, and I think that the arrangement's a good development of it. And
mm-hmm.
that's kind of what we were trying to do on the whole album, was take an old tune and develop it some way.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm going to change arms. Killing me. The album is, that's, how did you get them to let you do an album like that? Was it difficult? Because it's not the sort of thing which I would think a record company would figure would make them a lot of money.
Well, that's an interesting point, because actually when I signed with Warner Brothers, I went in with Lenny Waronker, who I had worked a lot with in the studio, and he thought I was good enough to sign. You know, he wanted me on the label because he knows that good artists make a good label, you know, whether or not it's instant sales right out visible, you know,
mm-hmm.
the track record or an obvious situation with, you know, single sales, you know. Plus, Van Dyke, I had a lot of association with, and he was totally oriented to anybody who's talented, and regardless of, because he himself has had no sales, you know, with his music.
He's famous for that.
He's famous for that, and at the same time, he's made hit records, and he could make hit records easily.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of these guys who could make you a hit record if he wanted to. But he doesn't think in those terms. So his influence and Lenny's sort of ear for better music in his kind of, you know, hazy way got me by the board, so that the president of the record company, Mo Austin, says, yeah, Ry Cooder, you know, I've heard about him, you know, and sounds pretty good. What's he going to do? Well, it's going to be great, Mo, you know. He'd tell him, well, okay, just don't spend too much money. You know, and then everybody thought I was going to make an instrumental album. Because that was the most obvious thing, bottleneck playing, strictly speaking, you know,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't want to do. And that was the start of the problem. So 8 months it takes to kind of weed through a lot of weird music that I knew to come up with an album that had it. We had to think in terms of a commercial record, because
mm-hmm.
you do. There wasn't, I wouldn't say pressure, but the directive is, you know, play, make commercial music, give us something we can sell. In other words, 2 minutes and 15 seconds, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to do? Condense something and package it and make it, you know, really audible to a promotion man who's never heard blues in his life, you
mm-hmm.
know? Because what's the point of making a record if they don't get behind it?
Yeah.
And they don't get behind it if they don't like it. You know, those guys have got to hear something. And their ears are good. You know, they know the charts and what's hip and what's not. You know, the hipness of it all, you know? Well, we were able to promote some kind of a feeling that grew down there that I was doing something that was really going to be spectacular and yet strange at the same time. And we got over that hurdle of just plain old obscurity, because I was afraid of that. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to make an ethnic record. I don't want to make just some kind of another traditional blues album. It's a terrible idea. Also a bad idea to do an instrumental record, because there's so many of them. And it's an accompaniment. My playing is an accompaniment to the voice, really. So the months roll on, and the money's being spent, and the costs are going up and up, and the guy, Mo, says, well, what are you doing in there? It must be great, but what is it? And, well, it's going to be good, Mo, you know. And then a couple of promotion men would come down to the session and say, man, they're really fantastic communication down there. They're playing this great music and putting it together. It's like a puzzle, you know. It's another Van Dyke Parks, you know, epic. Mm-hmm. Some of them said, uh-oh, that means a lot of money, you know, which ultimately costs over $50,000 to make. And yet, I think that they all appreciate the record, not only because they like me, which they do, you know, we have a nice relationship, but they like the music, and that's gratifying, to have record company like what I've done, because as you say, it's not a typical, you know, it isn't an out front record. A lot of people have said, geez, I had to listen to it a lot to get into it, you know, and I mean, that's the point too. You know, I'm not out to hit anybody over the head, which automatically takes you out of the realm of the big hot sound. When you put the needle on, boom, it's all there, you know. So I don't play that kind of music, and I don't have anything, it's not a philosophical statement, so it isn't like a head thing, like, oh, you know, now we're into some religious or you know, kind of situation. So, I mean, all those tunes reflect things that I like. I mean, the 30s, the depression, you know, and the kind of people that recorded those tunes originally were people that I identify with, you know.
Yeah, it's a beautiful record. It's beautifully structured. It took 8 months.
Right, 8 months.